time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. They call me the Sleep Science Guy. Today, we have Katie Ward. Katie is a PhD student at University of Alabama Medical Clinical Psychology Program, and she has been doing some interesting work with sleep and the elderly, so we're going to talk about that today. Just a reminder for those of you listening, you can always see this episode on YouTube, as well as hear it on podcast episodes and through UK Health Radio. Visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. So with that, Katie, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. I'm excited to talk about it.
Great, great. So tell us, before we even get into any of this, what got you into the grad program with an interest in sleep? What led you there?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was an undergrad, I worked as a research assistant on some sleep research. So we were looking specifically at what sleep deprivation looks like on cognition and some different things that you can do to help maintain cognition when you are sleep deprived. So that was some of my background when I was doing my undergraduate work. Since then, I did a lot of clinical work doing direct care with older adults who were struggling with addiction, and then also working in neuropsychology doing testing. And I just noticed that sleep is really important, no matter what the problem is. I think, you know, in addiction, there are a lot of people that struggle with sleep disturbance, and then also people who are having issues with cognitive impairment are struggling with sleep disturbance. And almost always, if you can help with that, then there are some really big benefits that come from that. So I think just the fact that sleep touches so many different things was what got me really passionate about just helping in terms of sleep problems and looking more into what the solutions are.
Great, great. So I'm so curious, as a student then, did you follow what you learned and give yourself a good night's sleep before an exam, or did you do the typical student thing and stay up and try and cram?
I did try to give myself a good night's sleep. I don't know that my sleep hygiene is perfect, but I definitely think it was probably better than some of my peers that weren't.
I just remember, you know, especially in law school, I tried to force myself to stay up, and I figured that was going to make me remember more. And of course, now I realize that was the wrong approach.
For sure.
Anyway, so all right, so let's talk about, I know you've been working on a study lately looking at the connection between elderly patients, fall risk, over-the-counter meds. Tell us, what is the study, what are you looking at, and what did you learn?
Sure, yeah. So our study is part of a much bigger study that's called Ambrosia, and it's something that Kaiser Permanente has been working on in Southern California. The actual study itself is looking more at hypertension in older adults as well as falls. But in that, they gathered a lot of different data, and some of that data was related to using over-the-counter supplements for sleep. And so we wanted to take a lot of the data that they collected and look specifically at what kind of risk factors we might be seeing in terms of over-the-counter sleep medications. So, and I think, you know, just a little bit of background, some of those medications like melatonin, valerian, Benadryl, those things are medications that doctors might recommend if they're not comfortable giving someone a prescription medication like a benzodiazepine or a sedative. And in general, we kind of already knew that those medications aren't always super helpful for sleep, but they're still recommended because it's something that someone can take. And there really haven't been a lot of studies looking into those kinds of medications and what the risk factors are. We know that in America, the what's listed on the label of those supplements isn't always accurate. So some recent studies have found that melatonin, if you get a supplement over the counter, you might be getting negative 83% to positive 478% of what's listed on the label, which is kind of scary.
That's a huge difference.
It's a huge difference. And it, I mean, that's just part of the fact that over-the-counter medications in America aren't regulated. So they really don't have to say what exactly is in the medication. So yeah, it is kind of scary to think about, okay, well, these are medications that doctors are recommending, that people are taking, that we don't super know what's involved in them. And so we wanted to look at, because we know that falls, taking a prescription hypnotic increases fall risk for older adults. And so we wanted to look at, okay, well, if the prescription is increasing this fall risk, what is the over-the-counter medication doing? So that's really what we were looking at. Some of our findings, we didn't find a connection as a risk factor, but we did find a connection in terms that the over-the-counter medication, if someone was taking that, they were more likely to have a history of falls. And so that was something that was interesting. We don't know if that means that it was just that their doctor was less likely to prescribe them the prescription hypnotic, which is possible, that because someone has a higher, incidence of falls in their history that, okay, well, maybe we're not going to prescribe the benzodiazepine. Maybe we're going to recommend they take some melatonin or something like that. But it also could mean that there is a relationship there, and our study just wasn't able to find it, maybe because we asked a yes, no question for the over-the-counter supplement. And so, you know, looking at things like how is Benadryl affecting someone versus how is melatonin affecting someone is very different. So, that's possible that we just need to be a little more specific in the next study.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you talk about falls in the elderly. What risks do you see that are different there versus anybody? Like, do you normally see more falls happening to the older population?
Yes, definitely. So in the elderly, we see 30 to 50% of older adults are going to experience a fall in a year. So that's a much higher incidence than we're seeing in younger people. And that's for a variety of different reasons. You know, there's a lot of different health issues that older adults experience, as well as just like having some more measures of frailty happen, just as people age, not having as much muscle tone, maybe being a little more off balance due to, you know, a variety of different reasons. Maybe they've had an injury in their history that makes them more likely to fall. Maybe they're having they are developing a movement disorder that prevalence goes up with age. You know, there are just so many different things that can contribute to that fall risk. And we know it is really impactful for older adults as well, that falling can result in some psychological impacts, and as well as physical injuries. And it even is one of the leading causes of death in older adulthood. So definitely impacting quality of life.
Wow. Yeah, it's... I know that just from personal experience that as people get into, I don't know exactly what age, but let's say 80s and 90s, just naturally with our body, the bones become more brittle. And so you end up having a fall, and instead of just getting a bruise, it's potential that you could break a bone. And then it's probably a longer healing process. I'm not an MD, so I can't say for sure, but I'm just talking from experience here. Did you ever work in a clinic or in a hospital where you had people staying overnight and any risks or anything related to that, or was that not your experience?
Yeah, so absolutely. I worked at, it was a residential facility, so we had people staying close to a month working on working on addiction, and the people that I typically interacted with were older adults. And so you can imagine if someone's detoxing or taking something for the detox, like a detox medication, then there are going to be more of a risk to fall. So that was definitely something that we had to watch out for mm-hmm. sure. And you're right, 100%, that the injuries, the kinds of injuries that can happen in older adults can be significantly worse than when you're younger and you can just kind of bounce back.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking to myself, you know, some of the tips that I give older patients when I'm working with them, I'm going to list some of them off, and then maybe you have some additional ones that you think are helpful, because I think, you know, might be helpful for the listeners. One of the things that I tell people is have a little flashlight by your bed. So if you have to wake up in the middle of the night to go use the bathroom or something, instead of turning on a big light that's going to really kind of wake you up, you can just have a little flashlight to at least see your way and get there. That's one thing that I tell them. The second thing is sometimes I see people will have like a small little throw rug or something by their bed. So when they put their feet out, if they've got a tile floor or wooden floor, they don't want it to be cold. But those things just slide all over the place. So I tell them, don't have that there unless it's secure in some way. And then another thing I found helpful is if you do have slippery floors, like tile floors or something, not that it's the prettiest thing, but it is a safer thing, is many of the hardware stores sell like a tape that has a rough top surface so that you get a little bit of friction when you're stepping out of bed. So instead of your feet sliding out from under you, they've got something to hold on to. So those are some of the top tips that I give. Any others that you want to add?
Absolutely. So I think too, just like you were talking about, making sure that the floor is not slippery. I think additionally, something that people can do is wearing those socks that have the grips on them, or having some kind of shoes that have grips on them next to the bed that they can wear to when they're having to get up to go use the restroom. Also just in general, I mean, and this is essentially what you were talking about, but making sure that it's not cluttered and that you're having, you know, having as even a floor as you can when you're walking a certain way. And then also if you are having a lot more balance issues, maybe installing a handicap rail or something in the bathroom to help and mm-hmm. make sure that when you're sitting down and getting back up, you have as much stability as you can.
Yeah. And I just thought of one other as you were saying that, which is the actual height of the bed, because some mattresses are really thick, and if you put it on a big bed frame, you end up having to almost, you know, climb a ladder to get into bed, versus some where it's easier to just sit down and the bed is there at that level. So I've had to work with some patients to either remove the box spring from underneath because it was too high, or make some sort of an adjustment so that literally as they got to the bed, if they were naturally going to be sitting down on the bed, it was just a natural motion as opposed to having to get up or go too far down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in this day and age, we do have lots of tools to increase accessibility for things and just make things easier. And you're 100% right. As people are getting older, it's just mobility is a little harder. So it's not a big deal if you're having to look into some options to make things easier. For sure.
Great. Well, this is a perfect spot for us to stop for a commercial break. So I'm gonna take a break, and we will be right back on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good. All right, Andrew Kolsky here with Sleep Science Today. We're talking to PhD student Katie Ward. So we were talking about elderly and sleep and over-the-counter meds and all that, but I know you're also doing some other studies. Can you tell us what other types of things you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the other analyses that we're looking at is trying to determine if older adults are responding accurately, or maybe how we would expect on sleep measures when we're comparing that to an objective measure of sleep. So what this kind of looks like is right now we're looking at how older adults are responding to the Insomnia Severity Index and how that's lining up to what we're seeing on actigraphy. So that's basically an objective way that we can look at sleep and see kind of what sleep parameters are. So how long is someone sleeping? How much are they waking up during the night? How restful is the sleep that they're getting? Those are all kind of things that we can look at on the actigraphy data that we're finding. And so we're taking that and then trying to determine, okay, based on what we would expect from the objective sleep measures, how are people responding on the Insomnia Severity Index? And what we're finding is that older adults have this tendency to underreport some of their issues with sleep. So even though someone might be waking up a lot during the night and having, 50 minutes plus of time that they're awake during the night, they are reporting sub-threshold insomnia. So not anything clinically significant, not saying that they have an issue with sleep. Basically just minimizing the kinds of issues that they're having with sleep altogether.
So when you talk about Insomnia Severity Index, what is that? Is that just some questions that they answer, or is it some big study they have to do? What does it actually look like?
Yes, thank you for asking. So the Insomnia Severity Index is a 7-question questionnaire where people can answer questions about how their sleep quality is, basically, and things that we would associate with insomnia. So like, are you getting as much sleep as, or are you getting enough sleep at night? Are you feeling well rested? Like those kinds of questions. And it's a validated measure. So it's what a lot of clinics will use to diagnose insomnia is the Insomnia Severity Index. So a patient is going to be, or might be given this survey to fill out, and then they'll answer it. And based on their scores, that might determine if someone is going to get treatment for insomnia or not. And I think another thing that I didn't mention earlier that is also important is that some other studies have found that older adults can also, if they do have insomnia, kind of exaggerate those sleep problems. So someone that is having some issues with sleep and they're saying, hey, I'm having issues with sleep, they might feel the need to kind of exaggerate what kinds of problems they're having, because maybe they think, oh, well, older adults tend to have sleep problems. And so if I'm going to get help, then I need to make sure that I'm, giving the answers that are going to give me help. Or maybe they really do have a different perception of their sleep than what's actually happening. So definitely the responses to those kinds of sleep measures are not necessarily what we might expect for older adults.
Okay. So they've got these questions that they're supposed to answer. They give a subjective answer, I guess, based on their best memory, or as you were describing, what they think they're supposed to put down. And then you said you're comparing that to this, and then you used the $10 word of actigraphy. So are you hooking people up to all sorts of wires and machines and things, or what is actigraphy?
No, okay, yeah. So an actigraphy watch is basically like a watch that would look kind of like an Apple Watch that someone would wear. It's probably not going to have as many functions or anything on it or be as snazzy, but it's just a band that someone would wear, and it's going to monitor light and motion while they're wearing it. And so that's something that we can use as kind of an objective way to look at what someone's sleep patterns are. Typically, when we're using actigraphy as a measure, we're also wanting to have a sleep diary as well that kind of gives us a guide of what that person is perceiving their sleep to be. Sometimes that's accurate and sometimes that's not super accurate, and you can kind of see on the actigraphy like where they're actually going to sleep versus what they might be putting down on the diary. And sometimes the diary is really helpful to determine those parameters as well. So yeah, essentially you can look at the data and it'll have activity and then it'll have light exposure. And you can kind of help to see with both the activity and the light where it's likely that someone's going to sleep, and then when it's likely that someone's waking up. And then the data will also give you how often they're waking up during the night and how restful that sleep is. So if someone is tossing and turning all night, that will kind of be given as a measure as well, so that we can see, okay, so maybe you were sleeping, but maybe it wasn't the best sleep overnight.
Mm-hmm. So you know, as I hear you describing the actigraphy, how do you respond to the skeptic who says, well, that's just a way for you all to charge me more because I have a Fitbit that'll tell me all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is a big debate in the sleeping community right now, too, especially in the U.S., because I think a lot of insurers are hesitant to provide coverage for actigraphy. And so this has been kind of like a back and forth topic. As far as a Fitbit or an Apple Watch is concerned, there is some promising research that maybe a Fitbit or an Apple Watch could be used as a method of assessment. But unfortunately, their algorithms are not open access. So one of the big issues that we have is, okay, well, we don't really know how they're getting their sleep parameters. We don't know what they're doing in order for us to be able to get these measures. And so we don't know exactly how accurate they are. Research is trying to catch up with that. And there have been some promising studies to come out to say that, yeah, it's pretty comparable to actigraphy. But because it's not open access, we don't know for sure until we get all of that validated that it is a useful tool for assessment. So I think that that's something that, you know, maybe down the road, we can use Fitbit or Apple Watch or whatever kinds of devices those are to kind of assess. But right now, we just don't know if it's accurate. And so we don't want to use something that we don't know for sure that it's giving us the right measure. And I think on top of that too, so some different kinds of actigraphy monitor or activity monitors that people wear, just like we would call it like a consumer grade wearable, that kind of watch is going to measure different things depending on the kind of watch that you're getting. So maybe someone's Fitbit is monitoring light exposure, activity, heart rate, you know, all of these different things. And maybe someone else's watch is only monitoring activity, and that's how you're getting the parameter. So knowing exactly what it's measuring, it would also be very helpful, but it also might mean that, okay, maybe your Apple Watch can do this, but not necessarily this version of Fitbit can.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a really interesting field because I've had the opportunity to attend a lot of current sessions about, they call them wearables. And I learned not only is there a thing called wearables, but then there's a thing called nearables, which are things that are placed near your bed, but you don't actually wear it when you sleep. And the problem is, just as you say, if you don't know, if you're a researcher and you're trying to do legitimate research, then everything has to be the same. And so if you don't know what the Apple Watch is measuring or what the Fitbit is measuring or how they're measuring it, you're comparing apples to oranges possibly. And then you get a study of 100 people and five of them wore an Apple Watch and 10 of them wore a Fitbit and 15 of them wore some other off brand that they got as a gift, you know, or a cheap one from us. It's just, there's no way to do legitimate scientific research, and thus actigraphy is something that gives you all the data that you need, you know, how they're getting, you know, where it's coming from, and you can be much more confident in the results that you get from a study, I guess. Yeah. Is another way to say it.
Exactly. And in terms of, I think this has a lot of implications for clinic too, right? Because right now clinics can't really use actigraphy very much, if at all, because it's not covered by insurance. And that's one of the major things that I think would be very helpful, especially when we're talking about older adult sleep, where people might not be responding accurately to the measures that you're giving them. And so you don't necessarily know if what they're telling you is true. Mm-hmm. And that's a really true measure of what their sleep is looking like. Whereas if you had an actigraphy watch, then you could have them wear it home, take a look at it and say, okay, well, this is what your sleep was actually looking like that night. I think that it is a really important area or topic of conversation, especially when we're talking about treatment, and especially in terms of treatment of older adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, tell me if I'm right or not, but I guess the reason that a consumer can't walk into a store and buy an actigraphy watch is because they're probably a whole lot more expensive, right?
Yeah, actigraphy watches in general are pretty expensive. And not only are they expensive, but you have to have the kind of data software that goes along with that. And being able to read that data can be kind of difficult. So it does take a little bit more expertise than just looking at what your watch is telling you your sleep parameters are. Like going on to Apple Health, you know, the app, and just seeing what it's saying your sleep is looking like is going to look a lot different than when you're looking at actigraphy data.
Yeah. And then, you know, just to add one more wrinkle to the whole picture here, there's something called orthosomnia, where, you know, I know there's a lot of people who are trying very hard to improve their health and track things and make sure they're eating the right thing and exercising the right way and getting the right sleep. And so you have these wearables that will give you these sleep numbers and, you know, how well your sleep is. And then what happens is people end up getting all this anxiety that their sleep number isn't 100, they're only at 80 or whatever. And then guess what? All of a sudden, they can't sleep because they've got so much anxiety over trying to sleep better that their sleep gets worse, and that's what we call orthosomnia.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, and that's a really good point, too, of like, okay, well, we're using wearables, and a lot more people are wearing Apple Watches and Fitbits and have more understanding of what their sleep is looking like. But, like, these perceptions of sleep are what goes into anxiety about sleep. And so maybe for some people, knowing more about their sleep can be just another like reason to think more about it and end up in this kind of like cycle of thought where it's not super helpful and it is causing more anxiety.
Yeah. I always find it, you know, interesting when, you know, I'm speaking to clients and I say, okay, so you're telling me that you weren't able to sleep and you were laying in bed, and what were you doing? Because I want to find out, you know, if they're scrolling their phone or watching TV or whatever, and they know they're not supposed to do that. So they'll say, no, I wasn't doing that. And, well, what were you doing? Well, I was trying to sleep. And I always say, well, what does trying to sleep mean? Because to me, trying to sleep means I'm sitting there worrying about the fact that I'm not sleeping and trying to figure out a way to sleep, which gives me more anxiety so that I'm staying awake because of the anxiety of me worrying about trying to sleep. And have you ever gotten anyone who can define to you what it means to try to sleep? Because I'm not quite sure what that means.
No, yeah. And I don't think that many people, especially not if they're coming to look for treatment for sleep issues, are defining trying to sleep super well. But yeah, for sure. I think that for a lot of people, that's what it looks like, is just laying there and actively thinking, oh my gosh, if I don't go to sleep now, then I'm not going to get enough sleep. And then when I wake up, I'm not going to be rested. And then tomorrow, I'm going to be groggy the whole day. And it's just like an endless loop where it becomes more things to be anxious about. And yeah, that all goes back to, okay, what is your perception of your sleep? And is it making you more anxious? That anxiety is going to make it more difficult to go to sleep. It's not going to be helpful. I think maybe, yeah, changing the idea of, okay, well, I just need to lay here and do nothing, to, okay, well, what is actually going to be helpful to relax and to not think about this?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this is a perfect spot for our second commercial break. So we're going to take a commercial break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, we are back on Sleep Science Today. We've been talking about sleep issues with the elderly, and we were just talking about wearables. Let's talk a little bit about dementia and neurodegenerative issues, because I believe you've done some work with that as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I have worked on, I used to work in neuropsychology doing testing with people who had neurodegenerative disorders and cognitive impairment, and yeah, so a lot of the things, or a lot of issues with sleep disturbance in older adults kind of go hand in hand with cognitive impairment for sure. So it's definitely something that I'm interested in and passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to keep up with the, you know, current issues, you know, of the day that the people are interested in. And I know over this last 6 months that I've been looking into it, there's a lot of new books and videos and things out about Alzheimer's as well as other issues and the relationship between sleep and cognitive issues, and there's just so much going on. You know, diet, there's a book out about the mind diet, and there's another popular book out about, I forget the title, but basically dealing with Alzheimer's and even, you know, reversing Alzheimer's is part of the claim in the book. Have you had the opportunity to work on any studies or deal with any particular issues related to any of those issues, diet or exercise or how sleep impacts dementia, any of those things?
Yeah, so I haven't worked on specific studies looking at how sleep impacts dementia, but I have been looking at how cognitive impairment might impact the ability for someone to know what their sleep is really looking like. And I've also specifically looked into a lot of different studies around this topic because it is really interesting and like you said, really important. One thing that we found is that cognitive impairment is something that can impact how someone is able to respond, like we were talking about on those kinds of surveys where we're asking about sleep. So people that are cognitively impaired are probably not varying their answers very much depending on how their actual sleep is looking. They're kind of just answering straight across the board, and they're not really identifying any issues that they're having with sleep, which is interesting because we know that as people get or as people have more cognitive impairment and more cognitive decline, you are going to see more sleep issues. and you mentioned Alzheimer's. I think that's a really good example is that people who have Alzheimer's often have this thing called irregular phase disorder, which is a circadian rhythm disorder. And what we're seeing there is that because Alzheimer's is a disease that affects the brain, and the brain houses kind of our natural clock, that as those things kind of break down, then circadian rhythm also kind of breaks down. And what you see is people who have like a very strange sleep pattern where they're really napping more so than they're actually sleeping at night. And so you see people kind of taking a lot of naps during the day, some naps at night, and having some really weird times that they're awake and doing things, which can be really difficult for caregivers and people who are trying to make sure that these people are safe, because it's also disrupting their sleep. So, yeah, cognitive impairment and sleep issues definitely go hand in hand. And I think one of the other things to consider in that kind of topic of conversation is, how are those sleep issues also impacting people that are trying to care for these individuals, and what kind of sleep needs might they have, or what kind of needs might they have for their sleep disturbance? So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I recently did an episode on shift work, and there's many, many jobs that do shift work, but nursing is one of them. And, you know, you think about a someone who's giving care at home to a parent or a loved one, and, you know, they can't sleep sometimes because they're having to get up to deal with, you know, some issue that's occurring. So you're right, the caregiver also has sleep issues. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, you know, from someone who's cognitively impaired, I understand it's going to be hard for them to answer certain questions on sleep studies and things. Have you done any work with or read any studies about whether cognitive impairment impacts sleep from a biological type of perspective, as opposed to just them maybe not realizing what time of day it is? I've never really looked into that. I'm just curious.
Yeah, so I have looked into and read some research relating to that. I think that we don't have a straight answer, I guess, is the first thing that I'll say. So it's something that's still being looked into, but we know that because sleep is kind of, so the brain has a really important job in terms of sleep. And so some of the things that can cause cognitive impairment are things that are also making the brain more unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so in that kind of realm, we can speculate that, okay, well, if the brain is having more issues in terms of, you know, maybe some degeneration, and depending on what areas that degeneration is, that's something that can relate to how sleep is looking and kind of the architecture of sleep, not only just being able to tell what time it is, but also just in being able to fall asleep in general. Like maybe melatonin isn't doing its job as well as it used to, you know, all of these different kinds of things that need to happen in the brain in order for sleep to start, might be impaired, just because in general, like the brain health isn't where we would want it to be. And I think that's one of the really important things about caring about brain health, especially in older adulthood, and doing the things that we need to do in order to make sure that our brains stay healthy. And I mean, those are things that we hear about all the time, you know, exercise right, eat the right kinds of things, you know, make sure that you're doing things for your sleep hygiene, like going to sleep and waking up around the same time every day, no screens before bed, you know, all of those kinds of things are really helpful in terms of making sure that our brain stays as healthy as possible. And for people with cognitive impairment, that's even more important to consider. Because if we already know that there's a problem and there's, you know, a decline, then trying to do as much as possible to slow that decline down is really going to impact quality of life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think those people who listen to the show regularly and watch some of the social media that I put out, I'm big on, you know, sleep is an important thing. But if you're trying to fix your sleep, but you don't pay attention to your diet, you don't pay attention to your exercise, you don't pay attention to keeping your mind active, all these things, in my opinion, this is not based upon a study that I have, but all in my opinion, are interrelated. And, you know, someone who is active, both keeping their mind active and their body active, and also eating healthy foods as opposed to, you know, processed fatty foods that just weigh you down, You know, how can you expect your sleep to be good if you're not treating your body and your mind well? And, you know, another issue that comes up is I deal with a lot of people who tell me that they're retired, which is fantastic. You know, they've been able to get to that point. But then they tell me, but I don't have anything to do during the day. So I end up napping a lot. And then they have sleep problems. And it's like, well, you know, if you're napping a lot, you're relieving all that sleep pressure that normally would build up for the evening time when you sleep. And so that's another place where we get into the conversation of what types of things can you do to keep your mind active, to be socially active, to be out among other people and doing things. And all those things, as you start reading the books about dementia, are things that help to stave off dementia. So it's all interrelated.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And that's something else, too, is that this is a bidirectional relationship, right? It's not just that, okay, well, if your brain starts getting unhealthy, then your sleep is going to be impacted. But also, if someone starts not sleeping super well, then that can impact your brain health as well. And because we know that sleep is one of the main processes of healing brains. And so if you're not being able to get that sleep and make sure that that process is happening, then you're going to see further decline or maybe even start decline where there wasn't any before, just because your brain isn't able to do the things that it needs to heal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of interesting information here, and hopefully the listeners are getting some tips that they can use to help themselves improve their sleep and their lives and their health. That's what this show is all about. So, Katie Ward, I want to thank you for taking time to join us today and share the benefits of your experience. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yep. And for those of you listening, after this show goes out on UK Health Radio, where we encourage you to listen to all the great shows they have there, you can also then see this show on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. So visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com, read up about the shows, visit our YouTube channel. You can get copies of a free ebook there if you sign up for our newsletter. We'll keep you apprised of new events and things going on. And we look forward to seeing all of you back on sleepsciencetoday.com and our next episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.